Okay, let me introduce a few concepts in the spirit of a more general introduction to biology. Biologists often frame evolutionary processes in terms of two aspects of biological organization known as the genotype and the phenotype. How many physicists are here? Okay, so then I should make these comments then. By phenotype, what do we mean by phenotype? By phenotype, biologists, the phenotype emphasizes the systemic nature of organisms. And, you know, at various levels of description, it might be the morphological level, how organisms are shaped, at the physiological level, at the molecular level, at the anatomical level. The evolutionary significance of phenotypes is that phenotypes adapt in the process of evolution, because natural selection acts upon them. It evaluates those phenotypes. Now, by genotype, biologists refer to the collection of genes that are contained in an organism, and together with the remaining molecular machinery of the cell, genes contribute to the maintenance and the day-to-day operations of cells. So why is it worth distinguishing genes particularly? Well, their evolutionary significance lies in the fact that genes are cause heredity. So because evolutionary variation predominantly occurs through genetic variation, and the variation of genes then affects phenotypes, and therefore leads genetic variation leads to heritable phenotypic variation, genes become evolutionarily important. So genes are things, or genotypes are the things that are replicated in the evolutionary process, but genotypes do not adapt. Phenotypes, that's what they give rise to, do adapt, but they are not replicated. It's important to keep this distinction in mind. There's a lot of confusion about that. So just to connect with Doran's talk, beautiful talk this morning, what evolutionary theory requires is that there be a correlation between the phenotypes of parents and the phenotypes of offspring. It does not make any prescription as to what causes this correlation. The fact is that in the life as we know it, this correlation is caused by genetics, but Doran has, rather than just direct phenotypic transmission, Doran has shown this morning a nice example of direct phenotypic transmission where there is no genetics. And so therefore the processes he described the structures he described can very well be subject to evolution without there being any genetics. Okay, why do I say this? I say this because, so this is evolution in a nutshell. We have a genotype that gives rise to a phenotype, and the process by which this occurs is called development in its most general form. Natural selection acts on the phenotype, evaluates the phenotype, and makes, therefore, the genotypes that carry this phenotype survive differentially. These dice here just symbolize that mutations occur at the level of the genotype, as I said. This is where random variation happens. Now, can we therefore say that mutations account for the actual evolutionary history, that mutations are sort of the major causes of the evolutionary phenomena we observe? Well, I think we have to be very cautious about that, because while genotypic mutations are entirely random, their phenotypic consequences are far from being random. The reason being that there is a process in between that carries us from genotype, from genes to phenotype, that funnels, you know, phenotypes consist of many. A genetic mutation expresses itself in a context, in a phenotypic context consisting of many components whose collective interactions funnel the consequences of a mutation, of some change of an enzyme, in definite, along definite directions. So while I might alter randomly a genotype, its effects on the phenotype are far from random because they're mediated by this process or this map. Therefore, if we're interested in, I mean, there's a great machinery that is available to us from population genetics as it started in the early 30s of this century in which we can ask the question, well, once we have different phenotypic variants given, under which conditions will one or the other survive? And that sort of describes the process of natural selection. We have a very good machinery for that. But there is a logical prior question to this survivability issue, namely, how do I get those variants? So how do I generate phenotypic novelty? How do I innovate? How does evolution innovate? You first have to generate this to access novelty, and then selection can differentiate and sort of act on the available variants. Selection itself is eliminative, it's not generative. And the process that generates novelty, of course, lies in this map from genotype to phenotype. I mean, the novelty at the genotypic level is trivial, it's just throwing the dice. You alter positions and along a sequence randomly. But the real novelty that matters is at the phenotypic level, and therefore we must understand how we go from sort of the trivial novelty at the genotypic level to the less trivial novelty at a phenotypic level. And then we can worry about, you know, then we can apply the machinery of deciding whether which variant then will survive under which condition. Now, understanding development, of course, is one of the major tasks today in empirical molecular biology. So that we are constantly unraveling intriguing facts about the processes that generate the phenotype from the genotype, like in embryogenesis. What I'm trying to do in one of the projects that I'm pursuing at the Santa Fe Institute, and before that in Vienna, is to cartoon this evolutionary loop at the level of a single molecule, sort of focusing on the simplest entity that is evolvable and for which we can speak sort of fairly reasonable of there being a genotype to phenotype map. That entity is a single molecule, it's RNA, so my interest in RNA resides in being the simplest instance of this general process. I have no stakes in RNA world or anything like that. So RNA to me is a molecule of choice because we have a handle on this map from sequence to structure, where the sequence corresponds to the genotype. It corresponds to the genotype because it can be copied by a suitable molecular Xerox machine in the test tube, and the shape corresponds to the phenotype. Because it can be selected upon, again, in the test tube, since these shapes convey some chemical activity or chemical properties, catalytic properties, under certain circumstances to these RNA sequences. The process of development, then, is cartooned here, sort of the process of folding, the process by which the sequence acquires the shape. I will not be so much concerned with this with folding as a dynamical process, then rather with a map. So we have a mathematical procedure by which I will tell a little bit about it, by which we obtain sort of the optimal structure that belongs to a certain sequence without sort of investigating the actual dynamic process of how this folds up in time. But just as, so this is the the overview. Yeah, I get to that, but I can jump to it immediately. So what I'm interested in is, as I said before, in understanding the process of innovation. How do these phenotypes vary? So I'm interested, basically, for physicists, this is a metaphor, so take it with a grain of salt. Call this P, the phenotype. Call this G the genotype. I'm interested in a certain sense in the first derivative, dp dg. How does the phenotype vary as I vary the underlying sequence? And are there statistical, robust statistical properties of this map as a whole that tell us something about the generic structure of such genotype-phenotype maps that while they hold in RNA, they might hold promise as well to be more general than RNA and hold for more complicated developmental processes that involve.
So I wouldn't just be specific to the development process you use, in this case, RNA folding, some something else. There's some general reason to believe that our neighbor is responding.
You say, is there a reason to believe that whatever I find about sort of the first derivative of this map is correct, is applicable to more general process? A priori, no. But you will see that what we find is those features are fairly, a plausibility argument can be made, and I will make, that these features carry over. But this is, at first, you can just take, this is just one particular example to study this process. I do then claim that what we find in this example, there are sort of conceptual lessons there that I believe carry over to more general genotype-phenotype maps that involve whole organisms. Yeah. So I was asked to introduce a little bit of RNA, but I think RNA by now is a known quantity or object. But just to repeat briefly, an RNA, RNA is a polymer, a heteropolymer made of four units, where a unit consists of a phosphate, a sugar, and a base, and the units are distinct from differ from each other by the base, and the nice, so RNA is a close cousin of DNA, and the nice fact about these bases, as you. So these are five bases here. In DNA, you have A, T, C, G, and C. In RNA, you have A, C, G, and U. So the T is replaced by a U, but they are very similar. Just this methyl group in T is absent in U in uracil. So RNA is like DNA, except that sort of one base is slightly different, and the sugar lacks an oxygen. The nice thing about these bases, I was saying, is that they tend to pair up with one another in specific ways. So G recognizes C, a guanine preferentially connects with a cytosine by stereospecific hydrogen bonds, and so does an adenine with a uracil. There is also the possibility that guanine pairs with uracil. So there is actually three pairs, GC, AU, and GU. So what this means is that if I have a string like this one, an RNA sequence, and two positions are complementary, by which we mean that they can pair according to rules I just stated, this string will tend sort of to connect at the point where these two positions that are complementary, where these positions are complementary. But what you get, what you have to do in order to do that, you create at the same time a loop. Now, a loop is energetically constrained, is entropically constrained, and so a loop costs energy. The energy that you gain by, the energy that you get the energy to make the loop by making these base pairs. It's not quite precise, but for this audience, it should suffice at the moment. So the consequence, so if you think of such a string now starting to pair up complementary positions, if we make the, if we introduce the constraint that, if they pair up these positions, you get a structure that you can depict in this fashion, and it's called a secondary structure. So the sequence runs from the 5' end to the 3' end, and here are just regions of complementary positions that align and pair with each other, forming local helices, or stacks, as we call them. And then there is a variety of loops that can form in order to accommodate these stacks, like hairpin loops, internal loops, multi-loops, which are loops where more than two stacks emanate, and structures of this sort. This so-called secondary structure, this is not, it's important to keep in mind that this secondary structure is not a spatial representation of anything. This is a graph that tells you contacts along the along a chain. It's a topological representation. such a contact graph then will acquire a three-dimensional structure by the real molecule will have a three-dimensional structure where that is in part stabilized by additional base pairings between, for example, such loop regions, where this, for example, could pair into this loop and so forth. And so you build up a three-dimensional structure. This secondary structure is a structure in which you do not have base pairs, that is a planar graph. In other words, I exclude, or we exclude, a pairing between loops. These would be so tertiary interactions, or interactions that belong to a three-dimensional structure. Is that so far clear? Okay. Sure.
It wasn't obvious to me that there's a clear difference between things that you call tertiary and things that you show in the planar graph. You said, for instance, that you have the hairpin loop, two of the hairpin loops might touch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, could you imagine their touching as being forming a contact, and then you have a giant loop between them?
You could represent such so-called pseudo-knots in terms of a superposition, in a sense, of two secondary structures, where the distinction is arbitrary. That's the answer, perhaps. The distinction is made, however, because it is so far it has been proven algorithmically useful. In other words, it can compute very effectively and fast secondary structure. But it is much more difficult to compute a secondary structure, including tertiary, including these pseudo-knots, that is, connections between loops.
Another way to ask this is, given a three-dimensional structure, is there a unique planar graph that you can draw?
Given a tertiary structure, whether there is a unique planar graph, and given the sequence, yes, it is compatible with that. Yeah. You don't think so? Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, you can, what counts as a pseudonaut then depends. Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Yes. Yeah, fair enough. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Is everybody seeing what they're talking about? Well, another way of representing this secondary structure, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but another way of representing such a secondary structure is in terms of such a string representation of balanced parentheses, where a dot represents an unpaired base and an unpaired position, and a pair of matching parentheses, like this one here, represents a base pair. Okay? So, if you can represent a secondary structure in such a way, then it is a if you can represent an RNA, this graph in such a way, then it is a planar graph, or it is what we call a secondary structure. Now, a pseudonaut would be a base pair, would be an open parenthesis here, for example, and its matching parenthesis in here, okay, which would correspond, for example, to a bond, to a base pair contact between one loop and another loop. That is what is called a pseudonaut. Okay, now what my colleague just said here was that that would be the proper sort of contact skeleton corresponding to a tertiary. On which then you build a tertiary structure. Now, how do you can get rid of that pseudonaut in order to could use the secondary structure in different ways, which gives you different secondary structures. And so the argument is that the secondary structure is not uniquely defined for a tertiary structure.
You used several colors for this and I think it's reason because if all of them are one color of the same black, then probably you can generate several structures, but if you color them properly, then
well, I think the issue was a different one here, but let me back up a moment. And for the purposes that I'm concerned with, it is an irrelevant issue, because what I would like to have is a mapping between is a model of a genotype phenotype mapping. Whether that model that model has a certain biophysical grounding, even if that grounding is not perfect, even if this phenotype or this structure is ill-defined, I still claim that the relationship between genotype and phenotype, the statistical properties of this first derivative, DPDG, still sort of are not affected by that. At least that is the hope. So I'm concerned about the degree of realism up to a certain point beyond which it doesn't buy me much more than just saying, well, it's more realistic, but it doesn't yield new concepts.
So the phenotype you are interested in your simulation is
the tertiary. No, the phenotype that I'm interested in, that's where I come. No, sorry, that's where I was getting to. So this is sort of the real map between a sequence and its tertiary structure. But what I will be interested in is not the tertiary structure, because I can't afford to compute it, and because I'm not so much in this whole process concerned. Well, I'm interested simply, I declare to be interested in this planar structure called the so-called secondary structure, which and again, because I'm interested in this, in the statistical properties of this derivative of this map, I'm not so much concerned with now the accurate prediction of single of individual instances. So I'm not in the business of predicting exactly, of trying to predict as accurately as possible the secondary structure or the pseudo-knotted structure, or for that matter, even the tertiary structure of a particular sequence. I'm rather interested in the features of this map as a whole, if I take sort of large numbers of sequences and look at their at effects that mutations have on the structure. And the hope is that despite this being a tremendous simplification compared to the tertiary structure, the some lessons, at least some conceptual insights, can be made that are not trivial, and that illuminate sort of the larger issue of the structure of genotype-phenotype maps and how they influence evolutionary dynamics. So let me make here briefly just a trivial, but important statement from which a lot will follow. The fact is that for a given, for sequences of length n, you have obviously 4 to the n possible sequences, but you have far fewer structures. In fact, I told you that this secondary structure can be represented by a string of balanced parentheses. So in a way, if you even forget about the constraints of balancing parentheses, it's a string made of three symbols, dot, left parentheses, and right parentheses. So they're 3 to the n. It's a bad upper bound of a possible secondary structures, which is clearly far less than 4 to the n. In fact, you can make recursion formulas and count these structures, and they scale approximately with 1.8 to the power of n. So the first observation here to keep in mind is that there are far fewer phenotypes than there are genotypes. Now, so the map is degenerate. It is a many-to-one map. If I were interested in a tertiary structure, and the tertiary structure in terms of its atomic coordinates, there would be no degeneracy, because every sequence will have a different tertiary, will have different set of atomic coordinates. There will be no degeneracy. The map would be one to one, and basically all the properties I'm telling you about will go away, But I think that level of resolution is biologically irrelevant. It's not meaningful, not the least because selection does not see atomic coordinates, but it sees sort of behaviors that might be mediated by those coordinates, but definitely not at that at that scale of resolution. Okay. Well, there are, yeah. I think a skip over algorithms, it's clear that there are many structures that are compatible with a given sequence. Each of these structures will have its own energy, and the energy, each of these structures, such secondary structures, are made, as I said before, are made of sort of certain components like stacks, loops of various kinds and sizes, and energies for those, free energies for those structural elements have been tabulated, and so you can assign an energy to every structure that is compatible with such a sequence, and then you can optimize, you can choose the structure with the minimum free energy, and you can do so in a way without enumerating all the structures by sort of efficient dynamic programming algorithms, which have been in the meantime extended. There are models in which you can actually fold a sequence, a secondary structure kinetically. We have extended the traditional algorithms for finding a minimum free energy structure to finding all the suboptimal structures, all the suboptimal structures within any desired energy interval, et cetera, et cetera. We can compute a partition function and so forth. So this map is known backwards and forwards. So, again, I'd like to emphasize that I'm not so much interested in the accurate prediction of individual shapes, and I would call this secondary structure now from now on shapes, just to simplify language, but I'm interested in the statistical properties of this map as a whole and how they influence evolutionary dynamics. Let me make a point here. The set of sequences forms a space, naturally so, because there are physical processes, namely mutations, that interconvert sequences. And so I have a notion of distance between sequences. How many? I will first of all be concerned only with point mutations, so I keep the length of the sequence constant. And therefore, there is a notion of natural notion of distance induced by these processes, namely two sequences differ, have a distance d if they differ in d positions, if their demutations are required to convert one sequence into another. So this is a metric space. At first, what this metric space maps into is a set of shapes. Nothing is said about what the space structure of these shapes are. That will be our major question here. You could say, well, I can impose a space structure on the shapes by just arranging shapes in terms of similarity. And so I have a distance that quantifies how similar, according to some criterion, two shapes are, and so I can arrange the set of shapes into a space of shapes. But the claim is that such a space structure is totally arbitrary and evolutionarily irrelevant because there are no physical operations that interconvert shapes directly that would then sort of induce such a metric. But the only way in which I can change evolutionarily one shape into another is by changing the underlying sequence and then going back by this map and seeing what the shape is that results from that mutation. So our main question will be eventually, how do we topologize, or how do we give us a space structure to this set of shapes that is evolutionarily meaningful, given that the space of sequences is metric and that we know the map from sequences to shapes, at least computationally. So a few observations about the statistical properties of this map. As I said, it's many to one. And if I were to fold all the sequences and construct a set of possible shapes and assign to each shape a frequency in the sense of how many sequences realize it, clearly that distribution of frequencies will not be uniform, but there is a notion of typicality. In other words, certain shapes are realized much more frequently than others. I think for physicists, this is pretty, this should come to, as no surprise. This is a log-log plot in which that chose the rank or the frequency distribution of shapes. So there are, you know, wherever you want to place your cutoff, but there are few shapes, say, of the order of the order of 100 shapes that are very, very frequent, and the rest then follows a straight line in the log for the power law of rare shapes. The important fact, however, is the following. If we define a typical shape, there are many ways of defining typical shapes, but so suppose one of the possible ways would be, say, a shape is typical if it occurs with a frequency above average. For such a definition of typicality, what happens in this map is that as we grow the length of sequences, the fraction of sequences folding into the typical shapes tends to 1, while the fraction of typical shapes tends to 0. I'm talking of fractions. So the relative number of sequences that fold into some typical shape divided by all possible sequences goes to 1, while the number of shapes in that set of typical sequences, of typical shapes, divided by all possible shapes, tends to 0 as a sequence length goes to infinity. But more and more sequences fall into fewer and fewer shapes, although the absolute size of the typical set grows exponentially, of course, but the set of all shapes grows faster than that. Grows faster.
I get to that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is an assumption, yes. And in particular, it's also an assumption that it falls into the minimum free energy shape, which, if you take a kinetic process of folding, that need not be the case. As sequences, in fact, grow long and longer, it's very unlikely that they fall into the, that a randomly selected sequence folds into its minimum free energy structure, but rather in some kinetically trapped structure. Yeah, these are all assumptions that go into that.
When you construct this map, you take into account the difference in energy between neutron base pairs.
Yes. Right, yes, yeah. These are tabulated energies that go into the algorithm, and they distinguish between GC pairing, AU pairing, and GU pairing.
Yes.
It can be twice as much, I think, even. What I should... You know, for the sake of precision here, what counts is not so much the base pairing between the sequences, because that doesn't give you much energy at all, since whatever you gain in hydrogen bonds by pairing two bases, you lose in hydrogen bonds that these bases have to water. So what really matters is the stacking of bases, the stacking interactions of the pi electrons of the ring systems. So that an isolated base pair doesn't give you anything, but you need at least a stack of two to obtain it. And those stacking energies, if I correctly remember, can differ depending on whether they're parallel aligned GC GC or GC CG and so forth, can differ to can differ by twice the amount. Yeah, I think the order of magnitude is 1.5 kilocalories for a GC per mole for a GC interaction, GC-GC stacking interaction, something of that order. That depends. No, if you could predict that, you could have a nice, neat characterization of what actually a typical structure is, and we don't have that. We know that typical structures are structures that have energies that are fairly below the average energy of structures in the sequence in this map, and that they must have they must allow for a combinatorial and that the sequences falling into those structures must be combinatorial. So, for example, a sequence that has a very good energy would be one in which one half is G, another half is C, but that is not a combinatorial sequence. There's only just one instance of that. So we don't really know what, you know, we can eyeball what a frequency, what a typical shape is, but there is no concise characterization of that. Otherwise, one could predict what this value is. This is what you were asking, right? Okay. Here? Oh, okay. In this case, the sequence space consists of only binary sequences built on GC rather than AUGC of length 30, and that whole map has been folded. So all the roughly 1 billion sequences that you can make, the 2 to the 30th sequences you can make, have been folded. So this is a complete, this is an exact distribution. This one here, you can't do this with AUGC alphabet. This is a frequency distribution of a further coarse-grained representation of secondary structure in which what I call loop structures, in which you're interested only in the topological arrangement of stacks and loops, but you don't distinguish between loops of different size and stacks of different size. So this is a further drastic coarse grain. This sort of collects a lot of different secondary structures here, in which the lengths of these loops and stacks differ, but they have the same relative arrangement of helices. And so this curve is for these type of structures. No, this is not, this is sample. No, this is not even exhaustive after. This is sample here at the level of these coarse-grained secondary structures. This is exhaustive at the level of the full secondary structures. In the sample that I was working with, yeah.
Is it obvious in the algebra 30 case that you have the GC element that the structures in that curve, where do the structures come from?
What these structures are? Yeah, why they are so frequent? Oh, the bumps. These energy parameters are being updated once in a while, every few years or so. And curiously, you know, as these energy parameters are updated, these curves become nicer and nicer. So that why these bumps are there is you could. These are small sequence lengths, and so you can make an argument of why a certain structure is so frequent and why it must be much, much more frequent than the next one or so. But this is a deep
stacking energy, right?
Yeah, this is stacking energy, but only
just stacking energies. How many? I don't know what the technical word is. Do you get nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor?
Yeah, stacking energy is quantifies an interaction between two adiation base pairs.
So you only include nearest neighbor.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, these are free energies, yeah. It is included, yeah. This is there's a temperature dependency on these energies. So, these are free energies. In other words, the minimum free energy structure will be temperature dependent. It's not like in the Hamiltonian. Well, what this graph just tells you is that there are few shapes that are very frequent and a lot of shapes that are rare. Now, where you want to place the cutoff that depend, that, you know, there are various definitions that you can make, one of which would be just take the average and say, and declare every shape that occurs with, that is realized by more sequences than the average shape is a frequent one. I think the important thing is that typicality is defined basically by this behavior as the sequence length scales to infinity, and there are many different ways of defining typicality. Being above average is one of them for which this holds. I don't know. Good question. I don't know.
You have a power rule on the top of the page.
Yeah.
So if 6.1 is higher than 1, then the statement on the bottom of the page
holds. But the question is whether it may hold for other distributions as well. That's what you're asking, right?
I think you need the power law.
It is a power law. So far, it can be fit by such a zip flaw for all the cases we looked at. But length of 100 is pretty much the highest we went to, and that only for loop structures. But fair enough. Okay. So just to fix here ideas, well, I'm running way behind. There's 1 billion sequences in the case of two letters length 30. They realize 220,000 different shapes. 93% of all sequences fall into 10% of all shapes. Well, these 10% are defined by being, there are 22,000 shapes that are above average in terms of sequences that realize them. So this is, yes, I mean, whether I count them as different shapes? Yeah, when I, yeah, shape is anything that the Michael Zucker algorithm gives me as a minimum free energy secondary structure. I could have single base pairs as well, yeah. They would, yeah. It could generate a lot, yeah. No, it is true. The realism of, I mean, the accuracy of the secondary structure prediction algorithms varies widely. For certain sequences, they're pretty good, but these are then sequences that are well-defined in the test tube as well, that have a well-defined shape. There are sequences that have ill-defined shapes, you know, as in the test tube, and for them, the algorithm will be lousy. It will generate sort of such single base pairs and so forth. So again, I don't think that any of the arguments I'm making really rests on, I mean, I believe it does not rest on there being you know, more accuracy than we have in this. Nothing much happens in term qualitatively. We have looked at these things, because in the exhaustive case you see them all, you can eliminate them, and nothing, you know, qualitatively nothing much. The numbers change, but nothing much changes qualitatively. Okay, well, let's proceed here. The next important concept, and I think one of the intriguing concepts that came out of this. Of this computational analysis is we can ask the inverse question. We can say, well, all sequences that have the green shape, please stand up in sequence space. So a lot of sequences will light up. These are these green sequences. And one observation is that they're pretty much randomly distributed throughout sequence space. But the more interesting observation is that they are not just isolated sequences, but that they form a mutationally connected network. That goes back to the question that I think you were aiming at. So, meaning that there is a way in going from one member of this equivalence class of green sequences that all share the same minimum free energy structure to another member of this equivalence class by a path in which every step consists of one or at most two point mutations, such that the path runs entirely through green sequences. You know, another way of thinking about this is as a percolation phenomenon. Given a certain sequence, I can put a number of mutations to that sequence that will not affect its secondary structure. So that number of mutants that share the same shape, I call the neutrality of that sequence. So that's important to, you know, that has nothing to do with fitness here. Neutrality just means that it has the same image, the same shape. If such sequences have of a given shape have a certain average neutrality, you know, then you make a step to one of those neutral neighbors, it too has this average neutrality. So you can sort of hop from sequence to sequence while keeping that shape, and you might be able to cross the space of sequences. And Kristin Reides has made made percolation models based on random graphs that give you where he can compute sort of the critical neutrality for which this percolation occurs. Such neutral networks are, of course, associated with typical shapes. They're not associated with rare shapes. I mean, it's just the flip side of the coin. In fact, I mean, in all of sequence space, there's only so much room for that many percolating networks. And in fact, I'd be interested in understanding if there are sort of physicists here that have means of computing, you know, given a certain a hypercube or some structure like that, how many different percolating networks sort of can find placed in such a volume.
That is a very similar picture for proteins, except that there they were showing compact structures and
No. No, I think protein people then picked up, or partly picked up on this and partly pursued this independently, and found these neutral networks with, you know, algorithms, partly with lattice protein models that are even far more unrealistic than RNA secondary structures as computed here, or by I mean, the internal structure of these networks still puzzles me today, and I'm not sure what to make of that internal structure. One thing is clear, these networks are far, at least for RNA, far from being homogeneous. So there is the notion of an average degree of neutrality is a really coarse notion. The neutrality varies dramatically from point to point, and in fact, recently, we by other routes and other questions we were posing to the system, we found that there could be regions in this neutral network that are so highly neutral that evolution grinds to a halt because there is not insufficient variability to actually, so which we call neutral confinement, where you really sort of, you know, it would be interesting to see whether you could lure viruses into such regions where they're then evolutionarily trapped. But yeah, so this just as a yeah, it's that. I don't know. It would require that you had a mathematically tractable, analytically tractable model of RNA folding, which the HP case in proteins you can make.
Does it matter to your whether or not this is a compound?
At this level of argument that I'm emphasizing here today, no. For other issues, it matters very much so. For example, like the question of neutral confinement and so forth.
There is a probability that you could calculate what is the, what is the probability that you get out of these domains, these neutral domains? That's a probability probably you could get out of these simulations, right?
To get out by what process? By just random walking or so.
Right. So that's an important thing, because if you are in a compact domain, you wouldn't get out easily, but if you are in such a network, then
I totally agree, and this is work that needs to be done. We became aware of the importance of this heterogeneity of neural networks, of sort of different connectivities across this green network, for example, only recently, and how important they are for evolutionary dynamics. And so this is definitely something that ought to be done. Neighbors in what?
How many neighbors? So whatever this randomized or compact, how many neighbors that is here? Because really you want to sort of walk directly to another one without going through a barrier.
Right.
Access like two structures, and that wouldn't help you that much. Whereas you have access many in a day.
Yeah. This was just to demonstrate what we just said. You know, take this structure here, and there is what I marked here by these pale dots that you may not see very well are positions for which there is at least one mutation that leaves the structure invariant. Okay, now I change this position X, which is a C here, into a G, and G is a neutral mutation. In fact, it leaves the structure unaltered. But what you see here is all the positions that have been marked with plus have become neutral as a result of this mutation. And one position that was neutral before has lost its neutrality, meaning there exists at least one point mutation that leaves the structure invariant. The same holds differently, that if I change the position this G here into an A, this is not a neutral position. The structure changes. But if I now make a mutation, the structure changes, it becomes this one. But if I now introduce a mutation in this altered background, of course I get a different structure than here. So what I try to say about this, in particular this part here, is that there is also an interesting question about d squared p dg squared. In other words, this map has a curvature. And what the curvature tells you is that neutrality is under genetic control. In other words, the amount of neutrality here depends on your sequence, is under genetic control. But if that is the case, then it can evolve. And if neutrality has anything to do with evolvability, because it sort of is the complement to evolvability, it sort of is it quantifies the capacity not to vary, then evolvability can evolve. And that is a whole other suite of questions that Günter Wagner has recently raised with others, and it can be studied in this RNA framework. But I'm not going into that. Okay. Same thing holds. I try to make a long story short here. So the same thing holds, of course, for the red shape. So I say, red shape, please, all sequences that fall into red, stand up. They too will form a network if the red shape is a frequent shape. Now, so why is neutrality, why is connected neutrality important? I think it is important for two reasons. One is, so far, neutrality, that there is neutrality, that there's a fairly widespread phenomenon we all know, not just from RNA, but from many other biological objects as well. But that neutrality is connected is important because it means that not only phenotypes are to some extent robust to mutations, so that they can buffer mutations. So neutrality is not just a buffer, an absorber of genetic perturbation, but neutrality is actually deeply enabling of phenotypic change. Without neutrality, a lot of phenotypic changes would not be possible. And by corollary, sort of major aspects of evolution would not be possible. So, for example, suppose you are here at this point on the green network, but the next best shape in a selection experiment to have is the red one. But the red one is not accessible in your mutational vicinity. So you are, however, not stuck to sort of in the traditional picture. You would be stuck here, and then you would have to, I don't know, wait for 7 mutations occurring in particular positions that sort of make you jump across some fitness valleys to the to a red shape, and that of course will never occur. Well, it will occur, but it may take longer than the universe is old. So, however, when you have connected neutrality, you're not stuck because you can still drift mutationally neutrally on this green network until at some point you come mutationally close to the red network, at which point a transition becomes possible. So what neutrality emphasizes is that you can drift along, you can move on such a network while keeping your shape the same. However, what you do not keep the same is your variability, as I suggested before. The potential for change changes. And in fact, here you still have the green shape, but your potential of becoming red has dramatically increased because now you're neighboring the red network. So, what it took us 5 years actually to understand that this obviously provides a way to topologize shape space. Why? Well, because you would like to call the relation, the nearness of shapes should reflect their genetic accessibility. So forget about similarity of phenotypes, because it has no evolutionary implications or implications for evolutionary origins. What you want to call the shape red near the green shape, if averaged over all the green sequences, there's a high likelihood of making one step, one point mutation, and landing on the red network. Okay? In that case, you would call, you would say the red shape is frequently accessible from the green shape, meaning that the network belonging to the red shape borders, is frequently in the boundary of the green network, and therefore the red shape is easily accessible from the green shape. Go ahead.
Imagine any evolutionary force or physical force which pushes the system, let's say, from 7 mutation distance along the neutral network towards the point where you can make just one mutation. So is it possible to do that?
Evolutionary forces. Well,
instead of 7 mutations, it just breaks in suitable.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a calculation, sort of how long it takes to sort of wait for those 7 mutations to happen if you just stand here and repeatedly attempt jumps. That's one. Well. The answer to that is you could imagine them, but that would be a whole different talk, because so at first you don't have to invoke, you already have an advantage if you just wait for diffusion to make this happen. There already is a qualitative advantage to just sitting here and attempting. Okay, but you're asking whether there is, it's a deep question, and I would answer the question with sort of recent work that considers sort of molecular plasticity, where we not only look at the minimum free energy shape, but at the whole repertoire, structural repertoires of shapes within, say, 3 kilocalories from the minimum free energy structure. And there, you suddenly start seeing the Baldwin effect at the molecular scale, I'm not taking time now to explain the Baldwin effect, but there you could start seeing forces by which what you say happens, or even the opposite happens, where you are actually driven by a reduction of plasticity into precisely those regions of extreme neutrality where you're isolated from anything else, and evolution grinds to a halt. But these are different talks. So, but the question to your answer is yes.
So this probably seems to relate to Merrill Carter's question earlier about the shape of these networks.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're balls rather than
fingers and branches. Right. Yes. Okay. So I call now a phenotype beta near to, so the is the concept clear? Sort of our red shape, call it alpha, has a neutral network. That neutral network has a boundary, which is all the set of, it's a set of sequences at distance one from that. You're shaking your head? Oh, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yes, this is to be kept in mind. I mean, physicists have, I think, an easy time anyway to deal with high dimension. This is a cartoon. This is a extremely high. The green network is a kind of sponge, and a red network is a kind of high dimensional sponge, and they are intertwined. You know, they don't overlap because by definition, but they're you're absolutely right, yes. So basically you're dealing with a structure that is all boundary, essentially, yes. So, but by boundary, I mean the set of sequences at distance one from every element of the green network, okay? That's the boundary of the green network. The question now, and I call phenotype beta near the phenotype alpha I just intersect the network of beta with the boundary of alpha, call it delta d alpha, and then divided by the total size of the boundary of alpha, and that gives me the probability, the likelihood of making one step out of the alpha network and ending on the beta network. Okay. So if we do this for a particular shape for this transfer RNA shape, so we make a sample of its neutral network, compute the shapes in its boundary that are realized in its sequence space boundary, then again we get a distribution like we saw before. However, there is a definite kink in there, indicating that there is a kind of correlation here where there is a characteristic set of shapes that occur particularly frequently in the boundary of the transfer RNA shape, and can sort of be distinguished from the rest, which is very rare. Admittedly, where you put this threshold below which you declare the shapes near this shape, and above which you declare the shapes not near, is somewhat arbitrary. But I think it's suggestive that there is sort of a natural cutoff point here that depends from shape to shape, of course. But what I'd like to emphasize is that there is, if we dichotomize in this way, we have constructed a notion of neighborhood. Given a certain shape, we can now assign to each shape a vicinity of other shapes, which are, according to this criterion, very frequently accessible. Let me give you a cartoon just to fix ideas. So what we did is we declared one shape, we declared nearness between shapes, not distance. I will immediately get to the point that this is not a distance, this is nearness. It's a topological concept. We declared nearness or defined nearness between shapes in terms of the adjacency of their corresponding neutral networks, not in terms of similarity of their shapes. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, I will immediately show you that this cross-cuts similarity completely. Just cover this because I made a mistake. So consider this as sequence space. And the individual states are the shapes, okay? This is, again, a cartoon. On the account of the topology I just defined for shape space, then the Pennsylvania shape would be near the New Jersey shape, because making one random step out of New Jersey is likely to end me up in Pennsylvania. However, the New Jersey shape is not near the Pennsylvania shape, because making a random step out of Pennsylvania is unlikely to end me up in is not as likely to leave me in New Jersey. So because neutral networks can differ in size, the nearness relationship I just defined is not symmetric, so it is not a distance. Because you could have a large network. Think of an ocean and an island. From the point of view of the you know, of the island, the ocean is near. From the point of view of the ocean, the island is not near.
But still, you expect that it should have this property that if you go from 1 to 2 to 3, it should give you the same.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, locally yes. If that's what you mean, if you look at. I'm talking about direct transitions from one network to another.
I mean, instead of exploiting the direct transition, I could go to others, right? As them.
You could.
So I think I should get the same probability by sum over the rest of them.
That.
I mean, there is gravity. You don't have the same probability of going downhill or uphill.
No, but.
That's what it's got.
Okay, we could discuss about
this. Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. Okay. So having defined nearness, I mean, I think for physicists there is no problem here. For biologists there might be a problem there, because they have been imbued with this picture of phenotype space as being a nice, regular, symmetric Euclidean vector space, you know, the Fisher's model and blah, 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 in which making a mutation is nothing much than adding a random vector to a certain position in that space, and there you get your new phenotype. I think what we're starting to see in RNA is that if you want a meaningful notion of phenotype space topology that reflects evolutionary accessibility, we have to abandon this notion of a Euclidean vector space. We do not have a concept of distance at that level. But if you don't have a concept, we usually think of topologies and neighborhoods coming top down, having a notion of distance, and then of course a neighborhood is just epsilon balls. But if you don't have a notion of distance, you have to go bottom up. You have to proceed axiomatically, define neighborhoods in terms of sort of topology, and then go from there. But once you have this notion of topology, you can rigorously define continuity and discontinuity in evolutionary trajectories. And so, for example, you know, this may relate to what you were saying. Going from one shape to another shape directly might be discontinuous, because either the networks don't border each other, or they border each other only rarely. But taking other routes might still make a continuous path possible. However, what we found in RNA is that there are certain shape transformations that are irreducibly discontinuous. In other words, there are certain shape transformations for which there is no continuous path that you could build. And so these are the genuine sort of discontinuous transitions that will show up in any evolutionary experiment in the computer, and I would claim in the test tube, to the extent that secondary structures have a degree of realism, and independently of fitness considerations or so. This is a classification of structure of shape transitions that are discontinuous, that are difficult to achieve no matter what, because not of fitness arguments, but because of the nature of the genotype to phenotype map in this particular in RNA. So just to give an example of continuous transitions, obviously are the elongation and shortening of stacks. No problem there. A continuous transition, for example, is the opening of a stack. But a discontinuous transition, evidently, obviously, to be expected is the closure of a stack, because you require a minimum length of a stack in order to offset the energy of the loop that you build. And that constrains sequences quite a bit. But then there is a whole set of shifts where one strand in a helix shifts against the other strand, which are all discontinuous transitions. And this is a nice example, for example, of a discontinuous transition between two shapes that are morphologically very similar. So there you see that similarity crosscuts this notion of nearness, because here two shapes that are very similar are connected by discontinuous transition. Up there, the opening of a stack generates a very dissimilar structure, but it is a continuous transition. So let me close here. There's a lot more could be said. In fact, I didn't even get to dynamics. But let me just wrap up a few manuals for you. So we have covered the notion of typicality, which suggests to me that evolutionary histories exhibit generic properties, because they are about typical phenotypes in general. Neutral networks, as I mentioned, neutrality does not only buffer change. I think the new point that is added here is that neutrality is also deeply enabling of change. That the boundary between two networks determines the difficulty of a transition, and that can be used to topologize shape space, and therefore to mathematically rigorously define continuity and discontinuity. For the mathematicians among you, I should say, it is not even a topology, it is a pre-topology. These neighborhoods are not open sets, but nevertheless, continuity can, we have sort of a whole paper that formalizes this stuff fairly rigorously. I did not come to shapes with covering, I did not come to plasticity mirrors variability, but I think that should be enough for our first discussion.
So, you could as well define a mismatch because of selection, right? I mean, you could, selection forces a kind of distance, a kind of nearness or similarity for the phenotype, because, I mean, the ones which are selected together are in a very similar, or, I mean, could you, I mean,
No.
If I define such a distance, then does it have?
No, the.
I mean, when you enforce the selection, you pick up some of them, and like, I mean, they should be friends.
No, I don't agree. The way we defined nearness here is clearly without reference to selection. It's just the map, okay? Now, what you can say is that given this topologization of shape space, is the genotype, you know, is the folding map everywhere continuous, for example? No, it is not. But it depends. You could topologize shape space in a similar procedure as I described, but with different criteria of what you mean by frequently accessible. For example, one extreme case would be you call all those shapes near a certain shape if those shapes are accessible by one point mutation from some member of the neutral network, okay? That's the weakest notion. If you do that, then the genotype-phenotype map becomes everywhere continuous, the genotype-phenotype map. The other extreme would be to say only those shapes are near to a given shape if those shapes appear in every neighborhood of every sequence on the green network. Okay, that would be the most stringent one. Most likely it would be empty, except for perhaps the network itself. In that case, the genotype-phenotype map would be almost nowhere continuous. So there is a sort of, one can debate whether there's a natural cutoff point in between. What I'm saying is that wherever you choose that cutoff point, the genotype-phenotype map will almost surely not be everywhere continuous. However, it is given a certain sequence and a certain shape that has a certain shape, there will be mutations that make in this topology a discontinuous transition. However, there will be mutations that will enable a continuous transition. Which path is taken, that depends then on selection and on the fitness assignments. So in selection, you will see, in other words, the fact that you might have an everywhere discontinuous genotype-phenotype map doesn't preclude the continuity of evolutionary trajectories. That depends then on the fitness assignments. But in our numerical experiments, what you see is you see discontinuous transitions that are selectively neutral, for example. You see discontinuous transitions that are selectively relevant, where there is an improvement in fitness. All I'm saying is that depending on where you place fitness, or what the assignment then of fitness to structures is, that will decide what are the actual structures involved in certain transitions, but it will not affect the transitions themselves, the nature of those, the class of those transitions. There will be always of this shift, flip, and so forth, you know, the classes that I have enumerated here. It will always be of this kind.
That fitness is still should use the fold in a way. I mean, if I define a fitness which is a very trivial and in a stupid way, like let's say the fitness is just the third sequence of the RNA and no relation to the fold. So then the whole story would be worse in a sense because it's a so.
But then I have no phenotype.
The fitness is defined. It should be depend on the structure that you have.
Yeah, no, I mean, if fitness is not defined on phenotype, then the genotype to phenotype map loses its meaning. Right.
Quite frankly, we can continue this.
Sure.